everybody, and welcome back to Don't Quit Your Day Job. My name is Paul. Welcome to 2024. As always, to start off this year, we have to have the man himself, all the way from Los Angeles, California, where all the derelicts live. We have Marky T. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Paulie, and thanks for having me on. As always, it's always a blast, always honored.
So is it snowing in LA, or how's the weather?
It's not snowing, but it's been raining. I mean, I keep joking with Kelly. I keep saying, hey, babe, I didn't realize we moved to the Pacific Northwest. I mean, it's nice, but it's like it rains and it's cold all the time.
The other thing that I was thinking about with LA is we chose the wrong paths in terms of making money, right? Because apparently if you play baseball and you sign to the Dodgers, you will make so much money, right?
So much money. I mean, I guess if you're a two-position all-star, that kind of counts for something.
Well, you played baseball in high school, so why didn't you pursue your baseball career? Jeff Bagwell, famously Hall of Fame player, went to our high school while we were in high school. Why didn't you pursue that?
I actually played with him in high school, and I played American Legion ball with Jeff, and my brother Fred was our coach.
Okay. So he's in the Hall of Fame, and you're not. So what gives?
Shut up. I mean, honestly, like I loved music too much, you know? Like, yeah. It was like, do you want to work hard at baseball or do you want to work hard on guitar? I can play baseball for fun and pursue guitar, or I can play guitar for fun and pursue baseball. And I went with music. It's in my soul. As much as I do enjoy playing sports and competing and things, it doesn't give me the same fulfillment as playing music does. And even though I'm just another broke musician, it's like I still wouldn't trade it, because getting to learn all these songs, it's learning another language and being able to speak it with my contemporaries that, right, I play with, you know?
But you are kind of athletic, right? You were a skateboarder. You played basketball with George Thorogood. Okay, not with George Thorogood. Go back to one of the earlier episodes and you can hear the George Thorogood story. But you're an athlete, right? And you're still in good shape. You're not one of those middle-aged guys with the gut, so his guitar is a little bit further away from his body. His hands have to go out. You're not that guy, right? So what is the 2024 exercise regimen for middle-aged Mark Tremaglia?
I play guitar a lot, really. I think that's my exercise. You know, I mean, working my day job doing the set lighting, right, I think that definitely contributes, because I'm lifting 80-pound lights over my head and hanging them from a truss, or, you know, running 80 steps up to the perms, which is like the catwalks above the stage, and my job, and then I lower down like a 200-pound light on a rope. So it's like, I think that's kind of my workout, really. And then I like to do sit-ups and push-ups and leg lifts and that type of stuff. And I'd like to say I watch what I eat, but, you know, I let it go in the last, I'd say, 8 or 9 months, you know. And it's not like I let myself go. I just allow myself now to eat a lot more chocolate or have a hamburger here and there, rather than just eating better. But I'm trying to change it in the new year and eat better now.
So you've always been, that's interesting, you've always been careful about what you eat. Not Brian Forsyth careful.
No. But I don't know. I don't like getting indigestion, heartburn, upset stomach. So right. I know the stuff that does that to me or makes me sick, you know. And there's a ton of food that honestly I love. I would eat if I could. And I know some people do. And then they have Tums. But for me, I go, you know what? I know the few, my limited menu is this. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm going to eat. And it just works for me.
So by contrast, I know that if I eat chicken wings with a certain seasoning, I will get a migraine. It triggers a migraine in me 100% of the time. And sometimes I still do it and get zero sympathy from my wife because I'm an idiot, right? But that's the way that it is.
Exact Indian food for me. Is it turmeric? Is that what is in there?
Turmeric. Yeah.
I eat, I'll have like, you know, chicken that is so delicious and all the vegetables, it's so good. And then seriously, I'll have a migraine within like an hour or so. And okay, like I learned my lesson on the road England because they love Indian food. Right. And we'd go out before a show, and I had played a show with a gnarly, I've never been so miserable on stage in my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you're not a big beer drinker, right? So that helps in terms of just empty calories, middle-aged guy with a giant gut.
Yeah. Again, I know what my body can handle. So I still drink cider. I'll have maybe a mixed drink like a vodka or a wine. But beer it messes my stomach up so bad. And the weird thing is I get an instant hangover the next day. I could have – the last couple times I'd have one Heineken and I'd wake up with a migraine. And I actually got sick once because of one Heineken the night before.
Wow.
So it just said that whatever is in it, it just doesn't agree with me.
What if you drink better beer than Heineken?
I tried that. Same thing. You know, and honestly, when I say not for lack of trying, I mean, I went to beer testing festivals, like with my brother, okay. Bob, you know, and it's like, and I still got super sick, and I was still like, I'll give beer another shot. But yeah. And again, I really limit myself. I don't like the drunk feeling. It's never been a good feeling to me. I feel out of control and everything. So I know my limit is two drinks, done, no matter what, okay. You know, and it's over the course of the whole night, you know, like two ciders or, oh, maybe a glass and a half of wine. That's it. I don't have the drinking gene in me.
So will you have a glass of wine before you play a show or no?
Yes, okay. For sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And I don't even feel it because usually it just gets me in the mood to get right. Crazy on stage.
All right, cool. And then actually one last thing that comes to mind, you have sober band members when you go on the road. So yeah. How does that affect like what's backstage, or do you still get wine and stuff backstage, or is it, you have to be more careful than that?
That's a great question, Paul, because yeah, I'm the only guy. They call me a normie because they're all in the program. Right. And so what they do is they meet a lot of times in the morning before we take off on the bus. So if we got a 10 o'clock call, they'll meet at 9 a.m. and have a meeting because mm-hmm. It just works. They need to talk. They need to go over whatever. Honestly, I've never sat in on one, but I can tell you this. The guys in my band are 28 to 30 years sober, and it's amazing that they do it, because what you were asking me, every gig we walk backstage in Europe, there is two cases of beer, two bottles of wine, a thing of vodka. You know, we may not even get fed, but there's always that. And then the other thing is, you know, as you know, German people like their alcohol.
Right.
And they're kind of people. We're on stage, they're liking it. I don't know how many times shots come up with like a, you know, beer. Right. And it's like, Ron, it's come to the point where Ron has a stock line. He says every time he goes, no thanks, no alcohol for me. I'm allergic. I break out in handcuffs. And he does the thing like with his hands together, like handcuffs. And everybody laughs, and no one ever actually like bugs anybody. And the bad thing is I'll have a cider or I'll have a glass of wine, and then everybody wants to buy me a drink. And right. I'm like, I have one and a half, two drinks tops, you know, but I got five shows coming up. I don't even want another one, you know? So.
Right. Have you ever been, I can't imagine this, but have you ever been too drunk to play? There's tons of stories of LA, Motley Crue stories or whatever, just too drunk to play. You can't actually play.
Not me. No, I've been inebriated on stage. When I played in that cover band, the Shagwells, doing the mm-hmm. 60 cover songs, yeah. By our third set with everybody buying shots, I've definitely been on stage going, woo, I'm feeling pretty good. But I've never been like I had a friend who had a birthday party once, and he laid down on stage while he was playing guitar, and I think he passed out for a minute because the guitar just started feeding back, and then he woke up, and then he stumbled around, and people are having their arms around him, and he's still trying to sing. And, you know, it was a birthday party, right. But it was a public birthday party because people knew him, and they wanted to come see it, and right. I was embarrassed for him.
Wow.
So, yeah, and that's not even the worst. I've seen people throw up on stage and pass out on stage, and yeah, after being on stage for 30 years, you're going to see it a few times.
What about when you were younger, especially when you first got to LA, maybe part of rehearsing when you're in a recreational band, like you're getting together with your buddies, part of the practice process is you're having some beers while you practice, you know, and you may never even play a show, but the practice part of it is the social part of it. So everybody's drinking. And then that leads to needing maybe the crutch of alcohol to even feel comfortable enough to play. But when you guys first got out there, were you so serious about music that that wasn't part of the practice regime?
Pretty much. Okay. Pretty much. I think my first couple of years out here, I didn't even touch alcohol. I was like, I saw people partying and going crazy, and I was like, it's not for me. But then I eventually just, it was my 21st birthday or whatever, so I had a beer and I was like, oh, this is fun. And then, I think, like I said, my friends call me a normie, or I think a teeter-toller is really what it is, because there's plenty of times where I play a show or go to a bar and I just have water. That's what works for me.
It seems weird to go to the whiskey or something in L.A. and drink a water, right? That seems weird to me as a non-L.A. person.
Here's a good one. I've played the whiskey probably 30 times in the last 3 years. I don't think I've had a drink at the whiskey because they don't serve cider, and they have like a beer and wine. And sometimes I just don't feel like wine. So I haven't drank.
Wow. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Mark Tremaglia, all the rock star stories. And I can't get those out of you because you just don't do that stuff.
What do you mean?
Like the Mark Taurine story from the Bullet Boys Houston thing, right? That's never going to happen to you.
No, I mean, not unless something clicks in my brain and I'm like, I turn into Nicolas Cage and leaving Las Vegas, I mean, that's probably the only shot of that happening. Right. What about you? So I know you drink whiskey, right?
I do drink whiskey, and I have what me and the rest of the band refer to as the traditional whiskey before we play. But I don't like to be drunk on stage. I don't like, again, it's a control feeling, right? I want to be able to play my instrument. But I've certainly been known to drink a lot after the show. And I think it happened relatively recently, maybe 2018. We did a show in Germany, and then everyone knew I drank whiskey. So then everybody's buying me whiskey afterwards. I met the drummer from this band called Sportfreunde Stiller. They were like, they're a German band that people know. And he was at the show. Like, he happened to know some other people. And so I went up to him, and I was already very drunk at this point. And I was like, hey, can I get a picture with you? And he's like, you know who I am? And I said, of course, I know who you are. But at some point, I simply fell over at that venue. Oh. I just like fell on my face. And I had a black eye. So that's my badge of honor.
My God, that's great. I mean, it's no Mark Terrain story, but it's pretty good. I mean, you didn't pull a butter knife on anybody,
I didn't. And Treetop, our trumpet player, walked me all the way into my hotel room. I do remember that. I was like, no, it's fine. I can get back from here. And it's like, no, I'm bringing you all the way to your bed.
That is hilarious. I could hear you too, because I know you'd be like, no, I got this. As we can see physically what is happening.
Right. And I had all of my gear too, right? I had my guitar and my little amp and stuff.
Well, that's a good friend. That's a good bandmate. Make sure you got in there safe and all your gear. And there's a story back in the Little Caesar days when they were partying. And again, to add on to your point, yeah, we used to go to rehearsal and there'd be a 12-pack of beer, they used to laugh when I was playing at Doc's House Mob because I'd bring St. Ides, that malt liquor, and I would always bring like a tall boy of that. But anyways, there's, talking about bandmates looking out for each other, Ron tells this story about when they went to Vancouver to record their first record, and they basically had carte blanche. So they had, they go to the bar and get alcohol for free. And Lauren at the time was heavily addicted to drugs and drinking. And he just started inviting everybody back to his room. And Ron goes, it's like 9 a.m. and I hear all this noise coming from his hotel room. And he goes, I'm going down to get breakfast. So as I walk by, his door's wide open. All these people I don't know are in there. His guitars are in there. And I look, and Lauren's on the bed, passed out. And Ron goes, that was basically what the record, recording the record was like with Lorne, And Ron goes, so I kicked everybody out of the room, made sure all his guitars were there, locked the door, and just left him alone, But it's like, that's what a good bandmate does, right? He doesn't they don't just pile on.
So in Vancouver, that must have been the Bob Rock record, right? The first one?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. Wow. Yeah, they have lots of crazy stories. The bar in the hotel was like, the bands get to drink for free here. After the second day, they said, you guys get one bottle of Jack. After the first week, they said, if you want anything, you got to pay for it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow. Crazy.
Yep.
All right. So leaving all of the debauchery behind, we're going to move into 2024 with one of my favorite Marky T segments, which is musical hot takes, to get your opinion on some of these crazy musician hot takes about what people think.
Okay.
All right. So here's the first one. Frank Zappa didn't make music, but instead wrote examples of how to apply abstract music theory. His albums are doctoral thesis submissions coupled with lyrics that display the sense of humor of someone capable of listening to a lot of avant-garde jazz.
Okay, professor. Like, what? Like, I don't think a music fan wrote that, just somebody that studies music, it would seem to me, because that just sounds way too analytical for what Frank does.
But that's the criticism, right? That Frank didn't actually write songs. He wrote, like, weird theories about music.
Well, did Bach write weird theories? Did Mozart write weird theories? I mean, seriously, it's like the dude wrote some, it doesn't maybe connect with everybody. I totally get that. There's stuff I listen to that I go, that's way out there, but there's plenty of stuff, Peaches and Regalia, you know, Black Napkins, things that any of us can hear and go, I get that. And on top of that, Frank was a great improviser. I mean, that was one of the things they would do in their live shows. There was segments, just because they weren't the Allman Brothers, he still improvised. There was songs where he knew, this area I'm playing till I give you guys the cue, because he loved jazz, you know? And I mean, that's really what his music is to me, is just jazz. And I wouldn't say Coltrane's not music, or you know, Coltrane has records where he's literally just going with scales, and it's unbelievable and nobody can do it. But you could say he's just practicing, you know, the Slominsky method. Like, what is he doing? You know, but no, it's great music.
Are you a fan of Zappa? Do you listen to Zappa?
Okay. I am. Okay. And I maybe have told this story on the podcast before, but stop me if I have. I didn't really care for Frank Zappa much. I did have the record with Valley Girl on it. Mm-hmm. But that was the only song. And for whatever reason, I liked the groove. So I liked the song. So I had the album. But then when I was living out here, my friend Blue Saraceno was friends with Dweezil Zappa. And we got to go up to the house a couple times. And I got to hang out with Frank and play all his guitars. I ate pizza with him at 2 a.m. in his kitchen, hearing stories while he's in his bathrobe. And I didn't appreciate it at that time. You know, I mean, it was cool. I knew he was Frank Zappa. But I actually was more like, I'm hanging out with Dweezil Zappa. Holy crap. This dude's, you know, like, he's my age and he's a star, you know? Yeah. So for me, I was like, that's cool. I didn't realize going down and sitting in Frank's studio and jamming and having him hand me Hendrix's guitar or his guitar from Shut Up, go, check this out. This is cool. Like, hey, I'll play this, you know, blah, blah. And we're playing and sitting in a circle jamming with these guys. It like was lost on me at the time how legendary and what a great musician Frank Zappa is and was.
Wow. That is insane to be able to say that you were in his studio playing his guitars. That's pretty nuts, I would say. All right.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
Moving on. Here's a short one. Fenders are the worst guitars ever made.
No, that's ridiculous. Come on. You know, I would say there's more professional guitar players that would say Fenders are more of a workhorse, better guitar than a Les Paul. If you put those as, you know, everything kind of, the mountaintop is a Les Paul and a Strat, and everything else just kind of trickles down to become what they become. And not that there's not some great peaks in those mountaintops, but if those two are the main guitars, I've been reading articles lately where I hear all these guitarists go, you know, I like my Les Paul, but the Strat does everything I needed. The Strat's better. For me, it doesn't work that way. And it's funny. I just, the singer Keith for the Blue Sky Revival, he sent me a quote this morning saying, this is Dickie Betts's take on guitars. And Dickie Betts said, any two guitar band should have two Les Pauls, one using the neck pickup, one using the bridge pickup, and then one guy playing the melody and one guy playing the third up the neck. And it's like he had a whole theory about it. And I was like, that's it. That's the Allman Brothers, you know, but it is a great sound. And I can always tell when Dickie plays and I can always tell when Duane plays. I know who's who just by the sound of their guitars, even though they're playing the same amp and same guitar.
So was Dickie a front pickup guy?
Dickie was the front pickup guy, and Duane was the both or neck.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Moving on. Good guitar players that, quote, don't know theory, end quote, still probably know more theory than you do. Don't use it as an excuse to not put in the effort.
Wait, guitar players, they know more theory than I do?
No, the idea here is that people use the excuse that good guitar players don't necessarily know theory, right?
Right.
As an excuse that so that they don't have to learn theory.
Exactly. And I used that very excuse as a kid until I read guitar magazines with Randy Rhoads. And then I was like, oh, you know what? I better at least know the scales, you know? So I learned stuff, but I didn't know how to put it together, how to do it. So that being said, Paul, I think musicians that don't know theory have a different, how do I say it? Have a different way of approaching the music. Mm-hmm. I can look at it from a theoretical point of view, but they're hearing maybe a pattern or they're hearing notes in their head already. You know, I mean, guys like Paul McCartney, they already have the song. You know what right. I mean? They just have to put it on their fingers and get it out. And it just becomes a pattern and a technique. And I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, you know, there's always Eddie Van Halen who constantly said that he didn't know anything about music theory, yet he was a classically trained pianist. So yeah. I think it's a bunch of BS. Right. And I think he right. just used that same trope that tons of guitar players use. But, you know, I think I've said this in a past podcast too, apologies. But when I took lessons from Jim Shepley, who taught Duane Allman, he taught me theory right away. So I know Duane Allman knew theory, you know, so.
Is it a badge of honor to be a blazing guitar player and say that you don't actually know what you're doing? Isn't that like some sort of weird, like hipster badge of honor to say?
I think so, but yeah. Think of the guys that say that, you know, like Mick Mars says that, Steve I doesn't,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like George Lynch at one point used to say that, but I know from hanging out with him, he knows exactly what the hell he's doing, yeah. You know, yeah. Like he knows the scales, he's patterned. So he has ways of knowing this chord progression and the scale match. And that's what we're trying to do. So you don't have to have a degree. You don't have to know music theory to know how to get scales that work over chords. You just have to be able to use your ear,
right.
But it just, it's easier to facilitate if you know theory.
And it's easier to communicate if you know theory, right? Because you're talking Absolutely. The same language, the same vocabulary. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, when I was doing that show with all the Slash and Steve Lukather and all of them, like with Slash, he was like, hey, I haven't had a chance to listen to Whipping Post. What scale do I use? And I said, Dorian. And he's like, what? Which one's that? And when I showed him, he goes, oh, got it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And that was it. As soon as I showed him the notes, he was like, oh, yeah, I use that fucking scale all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Whatever. Whereas Steve Lukather played LaGrange, which the solo is in the key of A at the end, but he thought it was in C or was the opposite. So he just had he knew his theory. He just had it kind of backwards. And then once he asked me the question and realized, oh, yeah, that's what it is, it was like nothing. So he was using theory, just
right.
He didn't realize what the chord was that was playing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Okay, next. Paul Reed Smith guitars are incredibly tacky looking. They're the guitar equivalent of a poorly done butterfly tattoo on a single mom.
Yeah, I for risk of offending people, I kind of agree. I've never been a fan. You know, when I worked at Sam Ash, I used to pick them up and play them all the time. And they really do have a nice tone about them, and they're very playable. But, I don't know. They look sort of generic to me in a way. I don't know.
I don't like the birds for sure. The birds are dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a personal thing for me, but like I just, yeah. I thought their double neck looked cool. They had a double neck at one point I saw.
All right, next. Relicking is dumb as hell. Most relic jobs don't even put the wear in places that make sense, and they almost never age the hardware so it stands out as fake from a mile away. It's paying a premium to pretend your instrument has a story behind it, but you just bought it like that from the factory.
Yeah, I kind of agree. Yeah. That's like, what are the distressed jeans? Same shit. Like, you know what? I can go roll around on my driveway and front yard and get the same effect and save myself $200. So the only time I think the relicking is cool is when they're doing replica guitars.
Mm-hmm.
So when they did like Mick Ronson's guitar, which he stripped down the paint off of and everything, when they made that, it would have looked stupid if, you know, like,
right.
Were they going to make a brand new one? Or Stevie Ray's guitar, you know, they did make a version of it that was like this kind of generic-y Strat with his pickup and his whammy bar. And it was like, I'd much rather have the relic, the cool number one looking guitar.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Playing in tune is a bourgeois practice of the decadent West.
What? That is the most ridiculous thing I ever heard. I mean, you know, there's a charm to some little out of tune pitchy thing, but a real out of tune thing it makes me cringe. And you know, something interesting about Van Halen, I was listening to an interview with Steve Vai, and he was saying the thing that struck him about Van Halen was he was a kid the first time he heard Running with the Devil. It was the first song he heard, and he couldn't believe how in tune the guitar was, because he knew the chords he was playing just by hearing them, but he was like, I've never heard anybody play it so in tune. And that's really a striking thing about that song, is when you listen to a lot of that 70s rock, there's definitely a little pitchy, out of tune stuff, but it's not bad that it bothers you. But I was watching some YouTubers play, trying to learn the songs I'm learning, and I always like to see how other people are playing it. And I heard somebody playing twice as hard, and it had like 800,000 views, nothing but compliments. And the dude was so out of tune. And it was like, it was making my skin crawl every time he hit the guitar. It was like, and I'm like, does he not hear that? But I guess he doesn't, and other people don't. So
I once played a show where the other guitar player, shout out to Mike Dunn, we were in drop D for the previous song and he didn't change out. And then we went into the next song and he didn't change. And so of course he's playing bar chords and everything is wrong, but he's looking around the room like, what's happening? Someone is wrong here. Who's playing their parts wrong? But of course it was him. So it was great.
I can admit to doing that exact same thing, Mike. So, I was doing that with Little Caesar. We have a song that's in drop D and the next song standard. And normally what I do is on the last chord, I play a D bar chord on the low E string and I tune it up, and I didn't. And we start playing the next song, and I was doing like what Mike was. I'm looking around like, what are you doing wrong? This is crazy. This doesn't sound right. And Lauren's looking at me with like a strange face, and it struck me. I was like, oh my God. So I stopped playing. I hit the tuner and tuned it up and then got back into the song, you know?
Oh my God. That's so great. Yeah. Okay. One more. And here's the big one, especially since I take lessons from you. If you can't play it clean or on an acoustic, you can't play it at all.
Nah. No, I think it's just a matter of playing it and playing it and playing it. So, and the acoustic thing, I mean, it's got six strings, it's a guitar, but it really is a completely different instrument in the way it feels and the way it reacts to your playing. So there's a lick I can play nice and aggressive on a Les Paul, but I pick up an acoustic and it's going to sound plink, 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 plink. It's not going to sound like music. Whereas on the Les Paul, it has a really cool tone to it. So I think the idea
here is that people rely on gain, right, to cover up their mistakes, which isn't the same as saying you have to be able to play everything clean. I think that's too far the other way.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't think, yeah, no. I don't know. I always think I play with a lot of gain, and then every singer I play with goes, can you get more gain on it? Can you make it gainier? And I'm like, no, this is how I play. I mean, I go, I'll step on this pedal, it'll boost it a little, but no, this is how I like it, you know? Like, I don't know.
I'm going to make you come play my Mesa then. So then.
I mean, there's some Mesas I like that have that mid-range punch they have is just so good.
But I play with a lot more gain than you, I guarantee it.
Yeah, well, I have an EVH. Those heads. Okay. I can't even turn on that. Even when I was doing, we did Creep once, you know that?
Yeah, your Radiohead.
Radiohead song. So I put it on the Eddie Van Halen channel to go, and it was so noisy and so gainy. It was almost embarrassing to do.
Awesome. Well, welcome to 2024, everyone. I want to thank everyone who's listening and supporting the podcast. And of course, thanking Mr. Guitar himself, Mark Tremaglia, for being on the show. Mr. Guitar, yes.
Paul Neal, Mr. Guitar, Mr. Fabulous.
Thanks, buddy. It's always good to talk to you. Have a good show coming up in a couple of weeks, and hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good, brother. Thank you. Always a pleasure.